This episode of Shaun of the South is brought to you by Case Knives, a tradition of my family dating back to my granddaddy who once said the best cure for idle hands was to build something, so keep your hands sharp with a Case Knife. And by Folklore Brewing and Meadery, quite literally, the best brew in Alabama. Visit folklorebrewingandmeadery.com.
Well, you are listening to Shaun of the South, and I'm your host tonight, Sean Dietrich. We are coming to you live via the podcast airwaves and radio waves all over this fine nation. Got a wonderful show lined up ahead of here, a wonderful show. This wonderful group of folks you see behind me here is Southern Rays Bluegrass Band, everybody. Southern Rays. Of our program is brought to you by visitnorthalabama.org, the Mountain Lakes Tourist Association. Visit the 16 North Alabama counties and make this state what it is. The North Alabama Hallelujah Trail, for instance, features 32 churches that are at least 100 years old, standing on their original sites, still holding services, and are accessible to the public.
Now, these are the portrait of North Alabama's history and tell the remarkable story of early Alabamans from the early days. You can wind through 16 counties, and the churches that you will see were the churches that were selected during an intensive two-year scientific research process, which included testing the walls with specialized equipment to detect whether or not actual shouting had taken place inside. See the white painted timber frame church that is St. John's Episcopal Church in Tuscumbia, built in 1855, or visit Mount Pleasant Methodist Church and see aged white wood and square nail and wood peg construction. Or visit my particular favorite, Pine Torch Church, a tiny little primitive log cabin in Bankhead National Forest built from the poplar trees in 1850. Pine Torch Church still holds church service every Sunday at 10 a.m. Be there or be square. So visit the trail of churches and sit in a pew or two and remember your fundamentalist pioneers who taught you how to sing good songs, believe in things, and how to feel very guilty for dancing at wedding receptions. Whatever you do, you can do it better in North Alabama. So visit northalabama.org or hashtag visitnorthal. Now let's have another tune here from Southern Raised Bluegrass Band, everybody. Southern Raised.
Down here I tend to worry. Down here
We're going to read you a little bit of our mail, a little bit of our mail sent in to us from listeners all over this fine country who had nothing better to do than to put pen to paper or finger to keyboard and tell us a little bit about what they're going through or what their life is like, or sending us letters asking us to cease and desist under threat of legal consequence. 130 episodes now I've told that joke, and it always works. Macy Williams, Salina, Kansas. Dear Sean, my son introduced me to your podcast, and it has been a nice treat. I wanted to use this opportunity to send a message to my son, who will hear it when he listens. Dear Jace, I love you. Thank you for being a good son. Come home anytime, and I'll make sure your favorite lasagna is in the oven. That is all. Thanks for the shows, Sean. Your friend, Macy. Richard from Santa Barbara, California. Next year, my daughter will go off to college, and it's a really hard adjustment for me. She will be going a long, long way from home, and I'm the kind of dad who can't go to bed until I know everyone is back home safe and sound, like most parents. So I might not be going to bed, Sean, for about 4 years. Pray for me. If she goes for her master's, I won't be sleeping for 8 years. But I wish I knew how to deal with the fact that my baby girl is leaving and that my home is becoming less full than it was. I miss my kids. Keep up the good work, Richard. Teresa from Lexington, Kentucky. I'm the head of my church's food committee for funerals. It is a big job because our funerals sometimes can be big. Last week, we had a funeral like that that was so largely attended that I ran out of food, and so we had an emergency. I had to send 3 ladies to the grocery store to buy cakes and salads and anything we could get our hands on. It was the first time, to my knowledge, any store-bought food had been served in our church. I wanted to die. But we put it all out for everyone, and they ate it all, and they seemed happy. They seemed satisfied. Sean, you've never seen people so hungry as they are when they're at a funeral. I don't know why that is, but it's true. I went home that night and asked my husband to cook for me because I was so tired I couldn't bear to look at another stove. He took one look at me and he said, "Honey, you look like you need a beer." It's a good thing I don't drink, Sean, or else I would have drank 4. Well, Teresa, it is a slippery, slippery slope into the arms of Anheuser-Busch, so be careful. Gigi, Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Sean. Great show. Want to give a shout-out to my daughter, who gave me a shout-out on one of your past shows for my birthday. So I'm sending this out to her. She's turning 27. She's the light of our lives. We miss her. She is living out in South Dakota right now, and we can't figure out why. We're waiting for you to come back, honey. Come back to us soon. Tell Brad, your fiancé, he can come too, but that doesn't mean we want him for a son-in-law. Happy birthday, Rachel. Not sure how to respond to that. Well, dear Rachel, from everybody here tonight, happy birthday, happy birthday. Aaron Smith, Reno, Nevada. When I was a little girl, I lived in Alabama, where I was born and raised. And I can still remember sitting outside on a porch with my granddaddy, listening to stories that he told. Stories that were funny. Stories that were more like jokes. And I loved listening to his stories. So thanks for the show. It kind of reminds me of that, although you're not nearly as good as he was. He always told this story to us. One time, there was a man in our town, and he was supposedly what you would call homeless, although back then, I don't think they called him that. In fact, I don't know how they even thought of him back then, because homelessness was a different thing. He used to sell pencils downtown, and he'd play a banjo in front of the hardware store. And anyway, one time, my granddaddy said some rough kids came through town and started teasing him, and they beat him up real bad. Then he was taken to a little hospital, and the people in my town got together and felt so badly about what had happened that they took up a special collection. Someone donated a piece of land, and the men in town built him a small house. Granted, it was more like a shack, but it was a house that he could live in. It was lodging. It had nothing in it but bunk beds and a wood stove and a fireplace, but it was a house nonetheless, and the man lived there until he died many years later. So, Sean, something wonderful came out of something truly horrible, and that was the story my granddaddy used to tell. I always thought it was one of his best. Take care, Aaron. Randolph from Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Sean. I know this show is about the Southeast, but I wanted you to know that it isn't all that different from the people I come from in Wisconsin, except we're colder than you are. In fact, sometimes it gets so cold up here, we have to open the refrigerator just to heat the house. Anyway, my dad was a farmer, and so were his brothers, and I was supposed to go into the trade myself, but I decided somewhere along college age that I wanted to be an engineer instead. But somewhere in my roots is the love of dirt and raising things, and so this year I am thinking of trying my hand at raising vegetables, or at least having a modest vegetable garden. Even though my wife and I have a track record of killing every houseplant we ever inherit, I think we're finally going to do it. Wish me luck. Keep up the good shows. Your friend, Randall. Well, Randall, you are a better man than I, Gunga Din. I have killed every tomato plant I've ever tried to raise. Maybe this is your year of salvation. Sarah Trent from Milledgeville, Georgia. I am turning 30 this year, and it's really weird. I feel older than 30 sometimes, but other times I feel younger than 30. It's a weird feeling to be between old age and at the end of young age. I'm still waiting for my life to begin sometimes. I'm not married, and I'm hoping for Mr. Right, but I'm at the age where I don't want to settle for Mr. Half Right. Sometimes I feel like I'm going to end up an old spinster if something doesn't happen soon. I really hope it does happen soon. Both my parents are gone, and I only have a few aunts left. Anyway, wish me a happy birthday if you would. Well, Sarah, from everybody here tonight who feels exactly the way you do, we are all just 18 years old inside, waiting for our life to begin. Happy 30th birthday! Jennifer, Van Buren, Arkansas. I was up late the last several nights with a cold, and I didn't want to go out into the den to watch TV because the sound would have kept everybody awake. So I listened to a bunch of your podcasts with my earbuds while I was drifting off to sleep in the recliner. Or sometimes I would lay in bed and just lay there wishing that I could drift off to sleep while you told a story. One morning when I woke up, your voice was still blaring in my ear through my earbuds, and to be honest, it was a little freaky to wake up with you talking to me. But you'll be glad to know my cold is better, and I just wanted to say thanks for helping me through it. Thanks for the stories. Well, dear Jennifer, keep getting better, and at least you weren't operating heavy machinery while you were listening. John Tilton from Georgetown, Colorado. I'm 23, and I just started playing in a local band in town. We play bluegrass music, and as a kid, I always thought that I would go places with my music. I knew I was better than most musicians, and in my little world, the people that knew me knew I was a really good guitarist, and so I guess I believed it. So I went to Nashville when I turned 19 years old, and I tried to make it there. I can honestly say I gave it my best. It is a tough town. I found myself working in a restaurant just to afford my rent, and I was playing with local bands, and they weren't all that good, at least not any better than the ones back home in the Denver area. So after 2 years, I moved back home, I don't want to say I gave up. I want to say that I gave in to something better. Don't get me wrong, I had a blast playing in Nashville, but I had an even better time playing for fun, trying not to make a living at it, but just being myself. I learned something throughout all that experience in Nashville. I know now that you don't have to be away from home to be a success. I think I'll stay put here at home. Keep telling us stories, Sean. I like them a lot. Thank you, your friend, John Tilton. Well, John Tilton, there's a reason they say home is where the heart is, and it doesn't have anything to do with cardiac surgery. Stay home, stay happy, stay healthy, and that's letters from our listeners. Letters from our listeners. And now we're going to have another tune here from Southern Raised Bluegrass Band, everybody. Southern Raised. I love old buildings like this. I love them a lot. I mean, I grew up in buildings like this. The buildings I grew up in were very modest. They were buildings that were built by men in the church congregation who got the plans out of the back of American Livestock magazine. And so when our churches were finished, they were built by the hands of the men who would be spending their Sundays inside them. And our churches were modest and no frills, and they looked a lot like God's potato barn. But these are the buildings I grew up in. Buildings with the window unit ACs and the leaky water spots above the altar. The buildings with the little crooked steeple and the rusted tin roof and the lopsided church entryway built expressly from 2x4s, which led into a church vestibule stained blood red heart pine floors that were warped from years of humidity so that when you walked across the vestibule, you felt like you were surfing. Those are the buildings I grew up in. The little fellowship halls, which had the little foot-operated water fountain in the back, and the water closet, which used to be at one time a coat closet and felt like it when you were in there, because when you tried to sit on the toilet, your knees touched the wall. The Mason and Hamlin piano in the sanctuary and the altar of God, where every week, even though we had the same 29 people every week for service in that little country church, our preacher would get up onto the stage and he would deliver the most brow-beaten, Bible-thumping, fire-breathing altar call you ever heard. And it didn't matter that when he was asking people to come down to the front to confess their most heinous crimes before God, that all 29 people in the sanctuary were second and third cousins. That's the kind of church I grew up in. I grew up among people who dealt in guilt. They dealt in guilt the same way Michelangelo dealt in clays or oil paints. We were modest people who did not believe in waving at each other in liquor stores. And for years, my daddy always wondered why, as a Baptist man, when an outsider would invite him to go fishing, why the outsider would invite more than one man from the Baptist church. Finally, my daddy asked him one day, he said, "Why do you invite several Baptists to go into a two-man John boat when it feels like that boat's going to capsize with so many of us? Why not just you and me?" And the man said, "Well, I learned a long time ago, son, that when you invite a Baptist fishing, you can't invite just one or he'll drink all your beer. But if you invite two, they won't drink at all." And that's the kind of building I found myself in one day. And it was the weirdest experience, because I was standing in this building and I was wearing my pajamas and I was barefoot. My hair was a mess and there was sleep in my eyes. And the last thing I had remembered was making an all-night drive to Birmingham where I had a speaking event to do, and I fell asleep in the hotel. And the next thing I knew, I was standing in this old building with the popcorn ceilings and the water spots above the altar. I had no idea where I was, and it was vacant. And I saw the little pane glass windows, the poor man's stained glass. They were painted with watered down acrylic paint, different colors on different panes to make it look like they were stained glass. And I could see through the window the evidence of the old two-seater outhouse. One for the men, one for the women. I had no idea. I was so disoriented and so disheveled and had no idea where I was. And I walked through the church to the very back door and I said, "Hello? Hello?" And all these memories came back to me of being raised in a place like this by the coiffed hair brigade of old women who raised me. And I stepped through the back door, and I still saw nobody. And so I walked across the church field, the overgrown alfalfa field behind the church, until I got to the trees, and I found myself in a little town, or at the edge of a little town. And I saw off-white houses lining a residential street, and I heard music. I heard music, and I heard the sounds of voices. Many voices. It sounded like a flock of flamingos. And so I followed these voices and the music, one step at a time, trying to figure out where I was. And on the porches of these off-white houses were men and women packed up on each porch. And they were all so happy. And I realized that I recognized these people. Each porch was outfitted with glass jugs full of lemonade or sugary tea, and people were sitting on their porch swings and up on their rocking chairs with their feet balanced on the banister, and they were openly cackling and smiling. As I got to the edge of the residential street, I saw a little downtown. The little brick storefronts with the plate glass windows and the colorful awnings and striped awnings and the hanging begonias on the street lamps which come on at sunset and the sidewalks which are rolled up at 7:30 so that no kids get into trouble. And the downtown was packed with people. People. And again, I realized that I recognized everybody in this town. I recognized every face. I saw Sister Jane at the very edge of this crowd of people running toward me. Sister Jane died when I was 7 years old. She used to babysit me. She came, she said, "Sean, Sean, oh, it's so good to see you." And she was totally unchanged. She looked the same way she always did. When she smiled, the lines around the corner of her eyes cut deep grooves into her cheeks like a road map. And she hooked arms with me and she said, "We're so glad you're here. We're so glad you're here." And I said, "Well, I am proud to be here, but where is here?" My Sister Jane didn't answer me. She just whisked me away and walked me into the town, and I saw that I was present for what used to be known as a street dance. Long ago, U.S. towns across the nation used to have street dances. They had dances open to everybody in the town. Everybody brought a dish or contributed a little something, and there was always a band, and I could see perched in front of the hardware store on a plywood stage was one such band. They had a doghouse bass and twin fiddles and a biscuit box guitar and someone playing the dobro. And there were people in front of the stage and they were dancing. Now these people, I did not recognize because they did not go to my church. We were the kind of people who did not believe in dancing. We were the kind of folks who, I went to a wedding reception when I was a child and I sat at the outskirts with my head down looking at my boots because I didn't want to make eye contact with all those people on that dance floor who were gyrating their bodies and dancing to the Twist or God forbid YMCA. And they were on that dance floor moving in these lewd ways that my people believed resembled a scene from the writhing bodies depicted in Dante's Inferno at the Lake of Fire. We did not believe in dancing, but it was nice to see these people dancing. I saw a few familiar faces, old men who were dancing with toddler girls whose little patent leather shoes were perched up on the tops of the old men's boots, and they were holding their hands and teaching them how to waltz and two-step. And I asked Miss Jane, who was holding my arm, I said, "Who are those kids? I don't recognize them." And she said, "Oh, them? Those are all the souls of the children who died in the womb." And I looked at her. And she smiled at me. And that was all she did. She said nothing else. We continued walking on a little bit, and we had a seat, and I could see that men and women were positioning card tables along Main Street, and they were filling these card tables with cornware and white bone china dishes and casseroles with steam rising from the top like locomotives. And I saw old men standing in front of deep fryers, batter frying chunks of catfish, dropping them into boiling vats of peanut oil and placing them onto huge platters with folded lined paper towels on the bottom, enough to absorb half of the Atlantic. And we sat down to watch the music. And as soon as we sat down, I heard the sound of what sounded like a stampede. Behind me, I turned and I saw coming up Main Street a pack of dogs, many dogs of different colors and sizes and shapes. Their ears were splayed behind them as they were in a full sprint toward Main Street. And their jowls were flapping, their tongues were hanging out, and their paws were striking the earth like a stampede of bison. And when they passed me, I saw six of my own dogs among the gaggle of canines. I saw a lady, a dog who I said goodbye to when I was a teenager, who died in my arms, black with curly haired ears. She was a stray. She came walking up on our porch one night, and she just slept in my bed ever since. And I saw Joe, The crazy dog, he used to sleep in my bathtub because he was skittish. You'd hear his paws late at night clicking on the porcelain, and he'd be getting into that bathtub because it felt like a womb to him. He hated thunderstorms. He loved playing outside. He got hit by an SUV, and it was a hit and run. And I saw Boone, the dog I took to the vet, and the vet said there was nothing they could do for him. And so I held him in the veterinary office as I watched red liquid be injected into his veins, and I saw Elime, the bloodhound, black and tan bloodhound who left an imprint on my heart, which will never, ever be erased. And as the dogs ran past the downtown, I stood up with Miss Jane, and she said, "Come, I got a lot to show you." And she took me to the edge of town where I saw the elementary school. And behind the elementary school was the old baseball diamond with the dirt field. It was overgrown just a little bit, the little poison ivy patch behind it where you just prayed to God nobody hit an outfield double. It's the old field where we used to play old school baseball, the kind of baseball where you use phone books for bases and your mama's welcome mat for home plate. And I saw people playing in the field, adults who I recognized. I saw Mr. Reginald, the old retired Methodist minister who performed a funeral for a Labrador belonging to a 7-year-old child in my neighborhood. He made us all wear neckties and khakis as we stood around that hole, and he gave a full service complete with a doxology and a scripture reading for a Labrador retriever. And I saw my old Little League coach standing at the mound, and he was pitching. And I saw a woman at the plate who I recognized. She was holding a Hickory Louisville Slugger. And she had long, dark raven hair and Hershey's Kiss eyes and ivory skin, and she looked like she belonged on the cover of Hollywood magazine. She was barely a teenager. And I knew that was my granny. I'd never seen her look so young. I knew it was her by the way she tilted her head left when she smiled. My granny had a wandering eye. Her right eye was a wandering eye. And so she tilted her head left when she smiled to get her eyes to focus whenever she posed for a camera picture or a photograph. Because of this habit of tilting her head left, my mother picked up on that. And she would tilt her head left whenever she smiled for a photograph, even though my mother has two perfect eyes. And because I have never been one to abandon tradition, whenever I pose for a photograph, subconsciously I tilt my head left. You should see my family reunion pictures. It looks like gravity is pulling the entire family to the west. She stood up at that plate and she swung that bat backward and she hit a ball that cracked and it ran right out into the field over the poison ivy patch and into that backfield, and she's trotted around the bases, and as she passed me by, she waved with a 2-finger salute. She said, "Hey, Sean," and she kept on running. And I looked at that old woman, my guide, Miss Jane. I said, "Where are we?" And she didn't answer me. After the game, I got a little hungry. So Miss Jane walked me back into town, holding my arm. We walked across the grass behind the elementary, back down to Main Street where the band was playing Turkey in the Straw, followed by Will the Circle Be Unbroken, followed by Just a Closer Walk with Thee. And I got a little scalloped edge paper plate, and I started holding it out to the old church women who were standing behind the long line of card tables filled with casserole dishes, and they served me baked beans and squash casserole and cheese casserole and chicken cheese casserole and chicken cheese casserole. And I saw a woman standing behind who I recognized. She was wearing a big old apron that said, "Kiss me, I'm Methodist." And she was holding a serving spoon that was about 10 feet long. She reached it out to me, and I saw her eyes roll upward from my scalloped edge paper plate to my neck, and then finally landed on my eyes. And she said, "Sean, it's you." And it was my mother-in-law, who passed just recently. She ran around the table, and she threw her hands around me, and she squeezed. And it had been a long time since I'd seen her. I said, "I want you to know we all miss you back home." And she looked at me very confused, like she said, "But this is home." And in that same moment behind me, I saw a young man standing in line holding a paper plate. He said, "Sean, don't you remember me?" I didn't recognize his face. And then he smiled and something sort of flicked in the tinges of his eyes. I said, "James?" He said, "Yes, it's me, James." James and I were friends when we were boys. When he was 16, he died on the interstate after coming home from his very first job working at a skeet range of all places. I cried on the front row of James's funeral with his mother and his sisters. But here he was. He looked right at me. He said, "Sean, look at me. Don't you remember when we used to climb trees together?" I said, "I do." And we hugged each other. We hugged each other so tightly that my ribs started to squeak. Then Jane pulled me away. She said, I have more people to introduce you to. And as we made our way through the town, I didn't even get a chance to eat my food. I saw people I hadn't seen in years. I saw cousins and old relatives and deceased aunts and departed uncles. And I saw my grandparents. I saw Cousin Elroy and Cousin Rose and Aunt Eula and Uncle Tommy Lee. And then Jane whisked me away again. She said, "I got one more person I need to show you." We walked past the school and down past the off-white houses all congregated together with the full porches of people drinking sugary tea and lemonade, and past the stop sign at the edge of town, the four-way stop, and past the hanging caution light and past the police station and all the way to the little river which cut itself across the town like a little silvery snake. And there at the shallow wooden bridge in the distance, I saw a young man seated on the bridge. And he was holding a fishing rod, long fishing rod, and his legs were dangling off the bridge with his trousers rolled up to his knees. He looked like the adult version of Huck Finn. There was a mess of red hair atop his head, and there was a smile on his face. And the man stood when he saw me, and I realized who it was. My God, I realized who it was. He came walking toward me, tall and lean, like a telephone pole with ears. When he got to me, we hugged each other before saying a word, and I said a word to him that I've been waiting to say for a long time. I said, "Hey, Daddy." He was still wearing the same shirt that he died in. His skin looked a little bit sunburned from too much time outdoors. And I could smell that unnameable scent that he used to have. Maybe it was his laundry detergent or his deodorant. I never really knew, but it was an unnameable smell that I haven't smelled in a long time. And as I wrapped my arms around his trunk, I could feel his scrawny body beneath mine. And I could feel his beating heart only inches away from my sternum, which is the sign of a good hug. I said, "My word. Daddy, where is this? Where am I?" He released me and he said, "You're in your pajamas. And your hair's a mess." I looked at him in the eye and I said, "Daddy, where am I?" He didn't say anything for a second. He only looked down and he said, "Does it matter?" I said, "Yes, it matters." I said, "Yes, it matters." I said, "Yeah, this is the most perfect and happy place I have ever seen. It matters because I don't ever want to leave this place." He said, "Well, now you know how we feel, because neither do we." And then, after having a wonderfully magnific experience, which I will never forget, which left an indelible mark upon my soul itself, I woke up. And I was lying in my bed staring at the ceiling. Hey, thank you very much for having me. It's been a wonderful pleasure. Thank you very much.
Hey,
Hey, thanks for listening to Shaun of the South. I've been your host tonight, Shaun Dietrich, and man, it's been a bona fide privilege coming to you live via these podcast airwaves and radio waves like we do every week. This episode is brought to you by Case Knives, a tradition of my family dating back to my granddaddy, who once said the best cure for idle hands was to build something. So keep your hands sharp with a Case Knife, and by Folklore Brewing and Meadery, quite literally the best brew in Alabama. Visit folklorebrewingandmeadery.com. The music you hear behind me tonight was Southern Raised, a group of award-winning kinfolk trained in classical music, but raised in the bluegrass of the Ozark Mountains. These guys have created a Southern Raised trademark sound wherein bluegrass meets classical music, combining the city streets and country roads together to give you a sound that is unlike anything you ever heard before. Trust me, when you hear them play Beethoven's Fifth, it will blow your mind and bless your heart. Visit SouthernRaisedBluegrass.com and download their music today on any platform you please. You will not regret it. To find anything more about what I do, you can visit shaunofthesouthshow.com, and there you can find archived episodes dating back to my very first episode all the way to this one, which you just heard, though I don't know why. You must have a terrible taste in podcasts. And while you're there, I hope you take the time to drop me a line, tell me about your birthday announcements, wedding invitations, the potluck socials, and I'll do my best to read that sort of stuff over there for my friends, because I love to do that sort of stuff for my friends. And friends, remember, when the doctor tells you to worry about your cholesterol, it's time to slow down on the bacon. Adios.